I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, welcome back to Tennis Podcast Towers at the end of day 8 of the Aussie Open. It's 5 minutes past midnight. David's here, Matt's here. The omelette is closed for the day. And on the big screen TV right in front of us here in our living area, we've got the Channel 9 app up on our smart TV. And there's a big picture of Alex de Minaur looking gritty and looking ready for the fight and looking ready to reach a first Australian Open quarterfinal, and he so nearly did, but he didn't. And somehow that picture that we've been looking at all week now has a slightly haunting quality about it. Matt and David, you were in the stadium. You were for large parts of that match on Rod Laver Arena, extremely pumped and sending me photo evidence of that pumpedness, and you've come back a little bit flat.
Yes, it was a fantastic night, actually. Just the whole occasion, the match itself was brilliant until the fifth set when it ended 6-love. And I was so impressed with both players. I don't think I've seen either of them play quite that well, certainly not in the flesh. And it was so impressive, so spectacular, the sheer number of lines they were hitting. And when de Minaur somehow wrestled the initiative and went 2-1 up, you know, requiring 2 tiebreak sets to do it, I thought he'd got it. And I don't blame him for not winning. I think Rublev was responsible for that win. I think he just took it back. He just wrestled it back. I thought it was awesome.
Before we analyse it all, full disclosure here, I did fall asleep right at the end of the fourth set and woke up on match point in the fifth. And now I think
so it's quite a short sleep.
it did nothing for me. It ruined me, actually. But I'm back. I'm back in the game. It's all good. Had a shower. We're cooking on gas now. But I think the reason that my subconscious allowed me to go to sleep was because I thought, even though Rublev won that fourth set, he looked on the ropes physically. I felt quite confident that Alex de Minaur had him in the fifth. And I woke up and it's 5-love and it's match point. So genuinely, what happened?
Rublev was astonishingly good right at the start of the fifth set. Like he won the last 4 points of the fourth set, closed it out to love, and then he won the first 8 points of the fifth set. So at that point, he's won 12 points in a row. And he was just awesome. He just didn't allow Alex de Minaur to sort of do what Alex de Minaur does. He just took over the rallies, Rublev. He was hitting down-the-line winners off his forehand and his backhand. And, you know, I think Alex de Minaur, look, it's so interesting. I find him in Australia really interesting. You know, we always joke about it, don't we, how hyped he is at this tournament. And I think what's perhaps the reason for that is because he keeps coming into these Australian Opens over the past few years having had brilliant results at these team events in the lead up to the tournament. And he looks an even better player than he is. He's already a great player, but he looks amazing at these team events. He's had wins over Djokovic and Nadal in the last couple of years. But he's not had a moment at the Australian Open ever. He's only ever beaten one player ranked higher than him at the Australian Open. And that was when he was sort of, you know, early days of his career when he was ranked 300 and something in the world. He beat Gerald Meltzer, who was ranked higher than him.
Not even Jürgen Meltzer.
Not even Jürgen.
Is this not Matt Stat?
No.
I mean, that tells me something because that is an amazing stat right. In itself.
The highest ranked player he's ever beaten at the Australian Open was Matteo Arnaldi, who he beat the other day. So he's not had that moment here in the way that he's had that moment at the United Cup and at the ATP Cup, even in Davis Cup. You know, he's been the guy for Australia. And I thought tonight was going to be the night when he went 2 sets to 1 up. I really did. He was awesome to win both those tiebreaks in the second and third set. And I just think that... I don't think he panicked, because I agree with David. I really don't think he did too much wrong. I think Rublev took it from him. But I think once he went to break down in that fifth set, it got away from him a little bit quickly. And it wasn't the physical thing, because he was really physically strong, as you said. It just maybe mentally just wasn't quite as engaged or focused or ready for that fifth set as Rublev was. And Rublev was just on it. And we actually ducked out at 5-love so we could get the...
I wondered how you got in that car so quickly.
We could get the early car home because, you know, it was done by that. And I really wasn't expecting that. I thought it was going to be nip and tuck all the way like so many of the sets have been. But it was an acceleration from Rublev, which is one of the things that we always want to see from him. And I think we did see it there. It was brilliant.
He has got better, hasn't he, Rublev? Kind of without us really... noticing, he's definitely an improved tennis player, because he, for a lot of people, us included, I think, was in the category of he's very, very good, he's doing his thing, he's going to keep doing his thing, there's no shortcuts against him, but there's a ceiling. And I don't think it's a, you know, a 180 rebrand, but subtly I think he's made some subtle improvements that are making quite a big difference.
Yeah, I absolutely, because the form that he had in sets 2 and 3 and that Dimonor was able to just about usurp in those two sets, that was not probably going to get it done in the fourth set. Mm. He had to produce something else, and it was a proper surge. He just started to... Well, he hit so many lines for a start. I mean, that's what was astonishing watching them, is the way neither one of them gives ground. They just stand on that baseline.
It was video game tennis, wasn't it?
Truly was.
Fast twitch, back and forth.
And I think maybe tactically, I think perhaps Dimonor maybe needed to change that a little more. I definitely kept saying, I think he should be going to the net more because he volleys well and he could crowd Rublev.
He does volley well.
And I thought he was missing a trick, but at the same time I was thinking, yeah, but he's 2 sets to 1 up, so I can, you know, guess maybe I'm not right. But I feel like when he needed to change it, when it was going against him, that was probably the move. But the Rublev surge was a thing tonight, and you're right, I don't tend to think of him as able to do that, and he did it in spite of the crowd. There was not a seat spare. It was electrifying in there. It's the first time I've had chance to sit in those seats all fortnight, and it was a pleasure to do so. And trying to understand being in there, you get the sense of what it is like to be Rublev and have to deal with all these people not wanting you to win. If he loses his temper, they boo him and hiss him and take the piss out of him. And he's having to just stomach that and rebound. And he did it.
Yeah, when the Aussie crowd were doing the pantomime booing and hissing of Rublev, I felt like, look, no secret, I love all that stuff, you know, provided it's the right side of the line. Generally, I love it, but I did feel like wanting to run on the court and intervene and say, don't you realise this guy has chronic, lack of self-belief. He has chronic lack of self-esteem. Don't.
You've got the wrong guy.
You've got the wrong guy. Don't. Not him. I did. Oh, my heart does just break a little bit for him. And he did his on-court interview with Jim Courier, and it was all classically Andrei Rublev, just absolutely not hyped on himself at all. Like, Jim Courier shouldn't be more hyped about you than you are, but that's just, it's just him, isn't it? There was a line that Hannah picked up on from that interview that just so perfectly sums it up. Better not to be inside myself, said Andrei Rublev. Relatable stuff, as always. And I really, as much as I'm talking about Andrei Rublev 2.0, and I really do believe that this is something different we're seeing from him, I still do believe he is going to butt up against the quarterfinal ceiling because of the section of the draw he's in. I do believe that there are other quarterfinalists, there are going to be other quarterfinalists that he could potentially break down that barrier against, but not Jannik Sinner. Not now.
Not based on what we saw today from Sinner. I mean, you were on the court, Matt, from start to finish. I watched a fair bit of it, and that was a match to perfectly encapsulate his progression, because it's been a really tough rivalry with Karen Khachanov in the past, who is just Mr. Beefcake, isn't he, as a tennis player? And it reminds me of when he faced Djokovic at the French Open, and I thought at the time, well, here's a test for Djokovic. It's clay. Khachanov can heave his forehand, and just, he looks so on it. And yet it was a handy victory for Djokovic. And tonight, or today, the same thing happened against Jannik Sinner. And that is the ultimate compliment for Sinner. You could properly compare him to Djokovic today, dealing with a really tough opponent and dealing with him efficiently and devastatingly.
Yeah, hard agree to all that. Rublev 2.0 is good, but not as good as post-puke Sinner. Like... that guy is something else. Watching him up close today, like, I know he just hits the crap out of the ball, and that in itself is an amazing thing to watch, but it's actually really smart, I think, a lot of what he does with the ball. Like, he does mix up the pace sometimes. He's pulling the trigger at the right times. He's not just always going for it. He's developed a bit of a backhand slice, which served him well today. There's a few drop shots in there. He hits with angles. Like, it's all so within his control, and it's all just so right. And he is really, so far anyway, carried on the form that he had at the end of last season, and sort of shown that this is a true evolution. The one tight period of the match really was the end of the second set, and Khachanov played this incredible shot to win a really long rally. And then he did a very Djokovic thing, Sinner, and he won like the next 8 points in a row to sort of win the set. And yeah, I was just so impressed. I love the energy in his box. You know, they're not too high, not too low. But they're right there with him the whole match. Yeah, I was so impressed. And it was fun being on the court. You know, you realise that the Jannik Sinner sort of viewing experience that people in the crowd are having, you know, they're gasping mid-rally at some of the shots that he's hitting. It really is quite something. And I think Rublev will do better than Alex de Minaur would have done. Like, Sinner absolutely crushes de Minaur. He tends to beat Rublev, but they do tend to be a bit tighter. But honestly, I'm so desperate for Sinner Djokovic right now. So desperate for it.
Yeah, well, the good news for you, Matt, is Andrei Rublev, by the sounds of things, gives himself absolutely no chance whatsoever. asked by Jim Courier in the on-court interview. I missed this. I must have been having my needing to wake up to record a podcast cold shower. He was asked about facing Jannik Sinner in the quarterfinals. Rublev goes, I don't know. It looks like I'm in trouble.
doing the analysis for us.
He's brilliant.
Not doing the hype job for us, but doing the analysis for us.
How can you not love him?
Everyone does, don't they? Everyone does.
Just to flesh out, the it looks like I'm in trouble. I think you couldn't really hit the ball better, I don't think, pretty much than Rublev did tonight. But Sinner hits it differently. Sinner hits it with spin that can get him out of the court. And Dimonor just cannot do that.
Yeah.
His flat ground strokes are spectacular, but they're in straight lines. They're like arrows. Whereas you can just imagine Sinner loading up on the spin, get him out there, and then pull the trigger down the line. Mm. You know, it's a different level.
So Rublev against Sinner in 2 days' time. The other quarterfinal on the men's side set up today is Novak Djokovic against Taylor Fritz. You'll notice we are no longer leading the podcast with Adrian Mannarino. That, folks, was probably a one-time only thing. Adrian, I hope you've enjoyed your moment in the sun.
Yeah. Turns out that, as I did for my stat the other day, being the oldest ever guy to win three consecutive five-set matches doesn't serve you particularly well for your fourth one, especially when you're playing Novak Djokovic.
Is that what was going on today? Would a fresh Adrian Mannarino have done much better?
He'd have done better.
Like than love and two?
Three.
It's a low bar, Matt.
Don't take one of his games away.
He worked hard for that game.
Which is annoying, because when you've got a love and love on your hand, the only salvageable thing from the match is a triple bagel. That's what we're all here for now, Ezra. Yeah. And he denied us even that.
Did you hear Djokovic say that he actually wanted to lose the game?
Yes.
Because he felt that the tension in the stadium was getting too much. And even he was stressing out. And he said, I'll give him the game and then reset and start again and just start crushing him again.
It's a great line.
It was
line,
a really good line. I do think all those matches in Mannarino's legs were a factor. But, like, I think he probably would have got about, you know, six or seven games. Like, I really don't think it would have been close. But I certainly think he was occasionally playing some nice points, but he was flat in compared to how he had been. I mean, I know he's never hyped, is he? But
well, he is when he's doing his T-shirt cannon thing.
Yeah, right. But during the matches,
no. one of Adrian Mannarino's things, one of, you know, sort of a just a perfectly typical Adrian Mannarino feature is that he doesn't have a kit sponsor. It doesn't have, you know, he wears a T-shirt from the local supermarket. He wears shorts from the 90s. Someone tell Adrian Mannarino that short shorts are back, because he hasn't heard.
Nothing wrong with the 90s.
Or doesn't care. And he has no, he doesn't even have patches on his kit, you know, the embroidered little sponsor patches. But Gino, famous patch sponsors of various French tennis players and others, they heard about Adrian's big Rod Laver Arena assignment today, and they got in on the Tequila Fun Times just in time for his Love and Three defeat.
it looked so wrong having
it
those
patches. It looked so wrong. It was so clearly last minute.
Yeah.
The things were hanging off his sleeves.
It looked like it had been blue tacked on.
It looked like my GCSE textiles project. Which actually my mum ended up doing for me. Thanks mum. I did the portfolio. My mum actually made the thing.
What was the thing? What did you have to make?
It was a cheerleading outfit. It was in my Americana phase that we discussed last night.
What are you saying about your mum's sewing?
It was great. I got an A.
Well, Adrian Mannarino wasn't getting an A.
No. That was what the project was like before my mum intervened.
Oh,
that's quite
see.
Hard for GCSE.
Good rescue,
yeah,
Catherine.
I didn't want to have to do textiles GCSE, but there was a rule at my school that you had to do something useless. so there I was, sewing. Or outsourcing sewing to my mum anyway. My mum would have done a far better job of Adrian Mannarino's sleeve patches. David and I were at the flat while this match was on, and there were a couple of other matches on at the same time, most notably Aryna Sabalenka and Amanda Anisimova, which were mostly taking our attention. And I saw some tweets going around about how ill and unhappy and not himself Novak Djokovic looked. And I said, David, we should probably switch over here. There's things happening. Switched over, 6-2.
Who were these people?
People are still saying it. People are still saying that Novak Djokovic is not right.
I mean, I think he's still a bit under the weather. I do think that is true. He's still with his tissues, and you know, still he doesn't look quite right. But his tennis in the last two rounds has been very different to what it was.
It's focused him, yeah. I think, hasn't it? But a lot of people pointing to seeming tension with Goran Ivanišević.
Yeah, I just don't see that as being a factor in the slightest. I think that's just what their relationship is like, and he feels able to let off steam in Goran's direction, and Goran gives it him back, and that's all I think there is to it. In Courier did actually ask him about how he's feeling, you know, and that he looked like he'd been under the weather the last few days, and he was very quick to kind of quash that idea that it was causing any issue at all. Well, I mean, take that as you like, but I'm not worried for him at all. I think that I'm like Matt. I just want to see the matches that are scheduled based on seedings. If he plays Sinner, I don't think there'll be any excuses either side unless something happens between now and then, because they both look right where they need to be.
It's Taylor Fritz in the quarterfinals for Novak Djokovic. He beat Stefanos Tsitsipas today in four sets. Apparently his girlfriend is going to eat a whole tub of Vegemite.
Which is actually the same content idea that we had for David.
We didn't say a whole tub. I said I might try a little bit of it. It looks awful.
Well, to be fair, Morgan looks like she's regretting saying a whole tub.
Yes, she's memed herself today, hasn't she? Go on the internet, you'll find out what's up. During the on-court interview, she used her fingers to indicate that she meant a small tub, not a large tub.
Right.
Yep. Taylor Fritz, four sets over Stefanos Tsitsipas. Who's got things to say about this?
Good match. Really good match, like better than I was expecting. I was a bit sort of worried about both of their form, I suppose. But actually, it was really good. And Fritz played extremely well. He served incredibly well the whole match, and he hit his backhand in the final set incredibly, like so many winners on that side.
I was going to ask you about his backhand today, actually.
It was great.
I know you don't have or believe in a men's list, but I felt like he made a play for it today.
He's always had a really reliable backhand.
Oh, that's damning by faint praise, isn't it? that's Matt's way of saying no thanks.
It doesn't do things for you.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't move me. Okay. But it's a hell of a shot. The thing about Fritz now is he's reached back to back slam quarterfinals. And that's notable because he used to go out of these slams really early. He has started to get better at winning the matches he should win at slams. This was his first ever top 10 win at a slam. So you could say probably, you know, one of the best wins of his career. Although, you know, there's a little bit of an asterisk, I suppose, beside Tsitsipas at the moment. He doesn't quite feel like a top 10 player. In fact, if Alex de Minaur had won tonight, Tsitsipas would have dropped out of the top 10. But I was impressed with Fritz, and I do think it's slightly unfortunate, but also a sign of the times and a thing that, you know, he's not the first person to run into this, that his first two, you know, his two Grand Slam quarterfinals that he's made recently, US Open and here, he's got Novak Djokovic in the quarters both times. And obviously that's unfortunate, but it can happen. And I suppose that just colours my view of this match, because I didn't see the winner being able to trouble Djokovic. You know, he's 0-8 against Djokovic, is Taylor Fritz. In fact, it was here that he played his best or closest match ever against Djokovic, in that one where the curfew came in halfway through. But I was impressed with him today, and if he's going to need to play like he did today and then some to have any chance against Djokovic. But he, in the moment, that's a good win for him against Tsitsipas. Although, you know, Tsitsipas, I think, played pretty well, but is not the same Tsitsipas as 12 months ago, who was reaching the final here.
He really doesn't feel like a top 10 player to me, Stefanos Tsitsipas, right now. He just doesn't. I mean, actually, maybe that's harsh. I think, look, I do think he's going to hang around in sort of 5 to 12 in the world, just on the basis of his talent and ability and what he's developed up to now in his game. But he does feel like an irrelevance now to me at the top.
I do feel that I'd like him to find a way to reset. And if that means taking time off and resting and figuring out his injury issues, the niggles that he's got, getting a new perspective in some way on his game by playing all the time the way he does, it just feels like rinse and repeat his game at the moment.
I don't think any of that is possible within the setup that he has in his tennis life. I think it's chaos.
And he does seem to just keep trundling along on the tour. Mm. And I don't see any urgency to think that there's a need to do much about it. And I'm only saying that from the outside. I realise I don't know what conversations happen on the inside, but I see the number of tournaments he enters, how little progress it feels like he's making. In fact, it feels like regression. And the results would support that. You know, he didn't used to lose to Alexander Zverev. He got absolutely hammered by him at the United Cup the other day. Taylor Fritz is a good player, but Tsitsipas was in the group with Medvedev between the Fritzes and the big three. That's where he was. And he's not there anymore. And that's quite sad to see. And look, he's young enough to be able to come again. But I don't see him just doing what he's doing now and it's suddenly changing.
And I feel like we're judging him by his own standards here, because there are players that would be content to sort of just ride their talent and be top 10 player, hang around the top 10, because that's a fun life, isn't it? And you're going to win a lot of tennis matches and make a lot of money and that's fantastic, and maybe you don't want to do the extra 5% required to totally max out your career, or 10% or whatever it might be. We know that Stefanos Tsitsipas isn't that guy. He was a factor, genuine factor, for long enough that we know who he is, and we know that this iteration of himself is going to leave him with regrets, I think, later in life. Which is why it just fills me, I feel a little bit sad watching him. There was a point in, I think, the last game of this match.
Final point.
Was it the very last point? Mm-hmm. Where Taylor Fritz is already a breakup, so Tsitsipas is serving, and he's serving to stay in it. And he goes break point, which is also match point down. It's foregone conclusion territory here. And everybody watching feels that. But this is Stefanos Tsitsipas, last year's finalist. The guy that's basically a home player in Australia. You know, there are so many Greek fans. This is pretty much as close as he'll ever get to it is as close as he'll ever get to a home Grand Slam. And he charges into the net in a pretty ill-advised way. And it's not a great approach shot. It sits up for Taylor Fritz to hit. And he does a sort of comedy gesture with his arms, sort of like sort of flailing like, oh, there's nothing I can possibly do here. Have the whole court to hit into.
I think he was trying to distract Fritz.
Do you?
Yeah, it was putting his arms up in the air as Fritz was about to hit the ball.
I read it as a waving a white flag. But he did have his back to me. I was at the far end of the court.
It was sort of both. Like, I think he knew the point was up, so the only thing that he could possibly do was do something to catch Fritz's attention and try and make him miss. It was one of those.
It made me sad.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It is a shame to see him in this situation, because he's such a bright addition a few years ago. And look, even much more recently than that too. I hope he can find a way.
I think that word you use, chaos, is the word, because he is doing some things that suggest that he is aware of some of the issues that he's having, and he is trying to make some improvements in his game. Look, we talked about his serve. He's trying a new technique, and he's also been using some new strings during the off season. You know, I think maybe all of this is to try and protect his body, help his body, just try and make him better. But it's not done in a sort of way that gives you much confidence that it's going to work or is being done in the right way. Like, just the perfect comparison to me is Jannik Sinner. Everything has been so organized and thought through and planned out and methodical. And look, maybe we were guilty of criticizing Sinner a little bit for being a bit too process driven, a bit too slow. Not slow, but a bit too sort of low with his ambitions, all that. But he had a plan, and that plan has been in place, and it is being implemented, and we're seeing the rewards now. And like, that is a perfect tennis team that seems to be together there right now. That is the complete opposite of what's happening with Tsitsipas. He may be trying things, but not in a manner that gives you much confidence that they're really well thought through. And it's a shame, and I can't see it changing unless there's monumental change in his team. And yet I don't think there's going to be monumental change in his team, because it's his dad. And it's
just on Fritz very quickly, I really hope that 0-8 record you mentioned, I very much expected to be 0-9 by the end of it, but I hope he comes out without the shackles on and just takes him on and believes. Because his body language at that US Open match, and he played one in the summer before it, he walks onto the court looking beaten.
And he said that in his press conference.
Really?
He said, I wasn't good the last couple of times I've played Djokovic, I know that. He cites the match he played against him in Turin in, I think, 2022, wasn't it? Which was
close. With the noise from the crowd.
Yeah.
Well, that Netflix made out, lost him the match. And it might have done. I think Djokovic lost in the match. but it was a factor, and he played really well.
He did.
Against him.
Yeah.
Djokovic had to pretty much bring out his best stuff to beat Taylor Fritz that day.
Yeah. So he's aware of that, I think.
That's good.
But it's a different thing, isn't it, when you get out there and, you know, he served like a dream today. He could serve really well against Djokovic and get his serve broken in the first game.
And that seems to be what happens a lot. You know, he gets it's like a boxer getting nailed in the first round, and it just really shakes them up, and they can't get their composure anymore.
Mm.
I hope he plays well.
Yeah. These are bad hype jobs for these quarterfinals, guys.
Tell you what, you wait till the semifinals hype, though.
Yeah,
we've got
saving up my hype.
I'm in trouble and a sort of sad. I just hope he plays well. It's going to be great, guys. Do tune in to the preview pod.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
We're going to talk about the women's quarterfinals that were set up today. I'm going to try and do a better hype job. But before that, I am going to tell you about On Location, the premium hospitality
and experience provider
that we're proud to be sponsored by. Throughout this Australian Open, I've been telling you all about the Olympic Games hospitality packages that On Location have for you available. If you're interested, I've been telling you about those throughout the course of this week. I'm now going to FOMO myself with some other stuff. On Location has ticket hospitality travel packages available for the following: BNP Paribas Open in Indian Wells, the Miami Open in Miami, the Madrid Open in Madrid, Roland Garros, Wimbledon, the US Open, and the Laver Cup. And crucially, we have a 10% discount for Tennis Podcast listeners on all 2024 Roland Garros official VIP ticket packages, courtesy of Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours. Now, those packages include lots of fun things, of course, tickets in great seats on Court Philippe Chatrier, but also detailed here, access to La Mezzanine at L'Orangerie. Now, I think L'Orangerie is where the draw is held. I think that is the official Ooh La La room.
Oh, yeah. That was amazing.
The official room of, what was the name of the rugby player that I thought had won a competition? To...
Antoine Dupont.
That's him.
Yep. That room, guys, you could get tickets to the French Open and you could be in that room, but not sitting there wondering who the
best rugby player in the world is.
Who I was about to call Francois.
You could be enjoying lovely French Open hospitality, cocktails, hors d'oeuvres, a contemporary and refined setting. Can confirm. So all of that is available, and of course there is that 10% discount code. So to buy an official VIP ticket package to Roland Garros and take advantage of that discount code, just go to toursfortennis.com/podcast. Tours, the number four, tennis, /. Oh, I've got it wrong. I hear this URL in my sleep. How can I get it wrong? Tours, the number four, tennis.com/podcast, and use the discount code, listen up here, Clay Season, CLAYSEASON, at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. Now, on to the women's quarterfinals that were set up today. We're going to have a Barbora Krejcikova against Arina Sabalenka quarterfinal. Sabalenka against Anisimova was the first women's match of the day that we all tuned into, paid full attention to. Some of us were on court for. Matt, your report.
Well, a slightly disappointing contest, I would say, in that it wasn't much of one. I made my way to the second court, and honestly, there was this kid in front of me who was really annoying me. He kept cheering Amanda Anisimova over backhand errors. At one stage, he said, she needs to play with the tram lines in, which was absolutely savage.
That's like...
And
bowling with those stupid
bumpers
up down the side. If you're an adult that bowls with the bumpers up, you're not an adult anyway. Carry on, Matt.
Noted.
Unless you're at a children's party.
Oh, I'll feel better.
Okay. So you know, I was in a bit of a bad mood, put it that way, because I wanted to just be watching the backhand in peace. But
how old was the child?
Old enough to know better.
Did you do lots of tossing?
I tweeted about him. I was trying so hard to be the bigger man, but
Matt texted the group and said there's some really bad parenting going on here.
Anyway, what I would say is, look, Anisimova's had a great comeback. She's won 3 matches. It's been a really good tournament for her, I think, exceeding expectations. I think there was great excitement for this match because of the head-to-head, the fact that Anisimova had dominated it, including on that court in the past. But we saw, you know, kind of like what we're saying about Jannik Sinner, we saw Sabalenka's a different player to who she used to be. She is phenomenal when she's in that mood. Like, I think to really trouble Sabalenka, you've got to get a lot of balls back. You've got to put balls in awkward spots. You've got to try and make her malfunction a bit. Think Coco Gauff in the US Open final, using that athleticism to extend rallies. That is not Anisimova's game. And Sabalenka just overwhelmed, overpowered, didn't really allow the Anisimova game to start flowing. She was brilliant, quite frankly, Sabalenka, as she has been all tournament. I left the court just, you know, a bit sad that I hadn't seen the best of Anisimova in that match, but just blown away and in awe of some of the tennis that Sabalenka can produce. She's been awesome.
I spent a lot of this match just sort of jaw on the floor at the tennis Arena Sabalenka is playing, but also thinking this woman lost a 6-love set to Elena Rybakina 2 weeks ago today, I think it was. Elena Rybakina, who lost 2 rounds ago, obviously still a brilliant player and played brilliantly that day. As Matt said a few days ago, that is about as flawless a performance as you will see all year. But how does Arena Sabalenka lose a 6-love set? Like that, it just doesn't really compute with me, given the tennis that she's playing. It just doesn't... I'm not saying she's unbeatable. I'm saying I just don't understand how she loses a 6-love set. It looks to me like she's through 4 rounds against the opposition that she's faced, like she's playing a different sport.
Yeah, she's plugged in to another level. I think that's the facts of it all. Yes, Rybakina was awesome that day, but it was also not this Sabalenka. She has... I'm always blown away by how she handles great shots coming at her when she's in this form. She can turn somebody else's weapon, a backhand from Anisimova or a big shot from somebody else, and just hit a clean winner off it, no matter where it is. It could come straight down the centre of the court where she's got no angle to work with. She was still hitting winners from those positions. So hard to do. You know, it's often easier if you're taken out wide or whatever. She's one heck of a player, but not just power. She's got hands. She's got everything, really, as a sort of classic big strike, ball-striking player and more when she's absolutely on it. And I don't think I've seen her at a Grand Slam looking better than this.
It feels to me like the only thing that can beat her is demons. Not Alex de Minaur.
What about Coco Gauff?
Well, see demons. Coco Gauff is a demon.
Because she's the player that beat her at the US Open.
At the US Open. And in this is an incredibly reductive take on that US Open final, and not necessarily the right one, but certly in Sabalenka's mind, she should have won that match. And yeah, I think it's possible she will cease to play this well if she takes on a match where the demons are there in her mind. I don't know, but it
definite possibility.
And we've seen it so often.
Many times.
Like last year's Australian Open final is actually the outlier. You know, if you go back to some of the US Open semi-finals she's played, the US Open final she played, the Wimbledon semi-final she played last year, the Roland Garros semi-final she played last year. Like, lots of great tennis, but also loads of unforced errors in big moments. And
not producing her best in those biggest moments on the biggest stages where the title or the final is on the line.
Exactly. So exactly as you said, she's looking incredible. I don't think she's ever looked this good through the first four rounds of a slam, but it's not really where the tournament's won and lost for Sabalenka. She's been so consistent at slam. She's constantly getting to the latter stages, and her conversion rate in those latter stages isn't amazing because of what happens to her in those big matches. So that's why I'm still, you know, I would never say, oh, Sabalenka's in this form, she's going to win the Australian Open, because it can go off. We've seen it. And Coco Gauff, as you said, can make it happen. I think.
It'll be Barbora Krejcikova in the quarterfinals. Coco Gauff would be Sabalenka's projected semi-final opponent. Krejcikova beat Mira Andreeva today. Came from a set down 4-6, 6-3, 6-2, ending Andreeva's incredible run. I commentated on this match. It wasn't the match that I was expecting at all. It was weirdly flat on the John Cain Arena. It followed the Fritz Tsitsipas match on, and I think that was kind of long and absorbing. A lot of people left, and they kind of did filter back in. But John Cain Arena, when it's rocking, it's great. But when it's flat, it is quite flat and kind of cavernous. The crowd are really far away from the court, incredibly different to court three, where Andreeva played her last match, and it's all very cozy and hotboxy, you know, it keeps the atmosphere in. So it felt a bit flat. It felt incredibly slow. A lot of people, including the pundits I was with, Daniela Hantikova and Andrea Petkovic, say John Cain Arena does play slower than all the other courts, and it was cold today. I know absolutely nobody back home in the UK right now or on the east coast of the US wants to hear people in Melbourne complain about 17 degrees Celsius. But for Aussie summer, it was friggin' freezing today. Matt had two jumpers on and was still extremely cold. And God, it really did look slow. And it was a tough scene, that first set, I've got to say, for both players. It was pretty low quality. I was really impressed with Maria Andreeva for winning it, because winning ugly is a heck of a skill and a heck of a feather in your cap to have at such a young age, especially after having had that perfect performance against Ons Jabeur. To sort of come to terms with, you know, I can imagine after that you just think, oh, well, I'm just, you know, this is what I do now. I just am brilliant.
I'm the bomb.
All the time. So to sort of just dig her heels in and grit out a really ugly set, I thought, good on you, that's great. But then she did start to flag physically. I think it just was all a bit much for today, very understandably. You know, it was a draining match a couple of days ago, coming from 5-1 down, saving match point. I'm sure the last couple of days afterwards and the couple of days before that, after the incredible Jabeur demolition, were draining off court. And I think it's very understandable that it all came to a head today. Quite interestingly, she, in her post-match press conference, this is an amazing little insight, she basically said she thought the 2-0 head-to-head that she has against or had against Krejcikova before the match today, that basically hurt her, especially after winning the first set. I think she basically said she got a bit complacent and that could be a reason for why she got flattened, de-energized out there. She thought she had her. You know, she's 16. She's beaten her twice. She's won the first set. Like, oh, yeah, like, of course I'm going to win. This is what happens when I play Barbora Krejcikova. And it, yeah, I think that contributed to her not being able to energize herself when it started to get away from her. And P.S., Krejcikova did start playing so much better. It's like she remembered, oh, I've got big weapons. I've got a really great forehand and a really great backhand, and I should just hit those shots and go for winners. This is good. I'm winning points. Great. And she did look, she looked really, really good. She beat Sabalenka last year on a hard court. She also lost to Sabalenka quite a lot last year. I think Sabalenka's going to win that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get great vibes, really, from Krejcikova that she's feeling fantastic about her game or that much of being a top player at the moment. It all seems quite a strain. And listen, everybody's different, but I've seen her in interviews before and I've seen her on court a lot before and she certainly seemed in a better place to me in the past. But that being said, she's still here. She's still in the quarterfinals, and that's good going. But I agree. I can imagine a scenario where Coco Gauff beats Aryna Sabalenka. I can't really imagine it happening here.
I think she's a bit disillusioned with what being a Grand Slam champion has meant for her. Do you know what I mean?
Do you mean...
I think she thought life would change more, that her status in the sport would change more.
Do you feel like she might reckon that she hasn't really been given the dues that
quite possibly
she warrants?
Yeah, and that could end up being a good thing. A chip on the shoulder is an incredible source of fuel in sport, and I think particularly in tennis. We have seen players power themselves to greatness with a chip on their shoulder.
I also think she feels a bit burnt from what I've heard, one or two things I've heard her say in the last 6 or 8 months, based on the because she said that line that we often refer to about how she feels like she should be part of it or wants to be part of the big four kind of thing. I feel like, and then it didn't happen. It really she fell off a cliff in form terms after that. I think she feels a bit embarrassed that it often gets referenced now. And yeah, I think she's probably, it probably makes you a little bit circumspect about saying much at all in some interviews. You do see that with players. I don't know. I am only speculating because I haven't spoken to her about it, but I do like Barbora Krejcikova and I love the fact that she's a great doubles player who's become a really top singles player and is able to play them both at that sort of level. And I'm happy she's back at an important stage of a Grand Slam, and it'll be interesting to see if she can push Sabalenka or take her out.
Thank you for salvaging some sort of hype job for that quarterfinal, David. Let's see what you can do about Coco Gauff against Marta Kostyuk. Both these two won incredibly comfortable today. In fact, they lost the same number of games. Kostyuk 6-2, 6-1 over Maria Timofeva, the qualifier, and Coco Gauff 6-1, 6-2 against Magdalena Freck. Gauff was sensational, I thought. Absolutely sensational. All these seeds falling by the wayside, and she's become a banker.
She managed to get that job done in the space of my nap. So you two better tell me all about it.
Yeah, she was very impressive. And there was this new feel to the tournament today. You know, waking up after Iga Swiatek's gone out, And everyone knows how open that top half is. But I suppose if you're in the bottom half, you've just got to, you know, it doesn't change that much for you right now. You've just got to take care of your own business. And she did that brilliantly. I think it was her best performance so far. Sort of all aspects of her game were good. It's just so interesting to me. The Coco Gauff experience at this Grand Slam is totally different to the one we just had at the US Open, where she is the star. She is scheduled in the night sessions most of the time. The days revolve around Coco Gauff, and she's playing all the time because she's playing doubles as well. You know, here, she's not playing doubles because Jessica Pegula pulled out. She's playing the first match of the day on the Rod Laver Arena, which, you know, isn't the biggest slot by any means. And I don't feel like Australia really, I don't know, knows Coco Gauff all that much yet. This is her first real run here. You know, she made her breakout at Wimbledon. She's been to the French Open final. Obviously, we know she's won the US Open. Like, it just is totally different. And I think Gauff is quite enjoying it. I think she's enjoying how relaxed and low-key it is compared to New York. You know, she went to the cinema this afternoon and did things that she just wouldn't normally do. She had a cardio session after she'd beaten Magdalena Freck.
Oh, that's a burn, isn't it?
Right. she's just, you know, it's been much more relaxed, and I think she's enjoying that, and I think it could serve her in good stead for this tournament going forward.
Do we know what she saw at the cinema at all?
She saw that new film that Zac Efron's in.
Yeah.
Iron Claw?
Claw. I think it's about wrestling.
Oh, good. I like wrestling. Like WWE or like Olympic wrestling?
I don't think it's WWE.
I don't think there are a disproportionate number of wrestling films in the world.
It's quite a popular film.
There was The Wrestler.
Yep. And Bruce Springsteen soundtrack.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Great song.
Yeah, that is a great song. If you ever... I was just started to do lyrics. No, this isn't a film podcast. It's described as sport / thriller, the genre.
I think you'd like it, David.
I'm pumped.
It's Jeremy Allen White and Zac Efron.
I know one of those.
He's in, Jeremy Allen White is in The Bear, which I've recommended to you before. So you'll probably watch it in about 12 years' time.
It's on my list with the other 60.
Coco Gauff will face Marta Kostyuk in the quarterfinals. Kostyuk, as I said, beat Timofeeva 6-2, 6-1. Look, the tennis has been great from Marta Kostyuk. This is the tournament where she made her breakthrough as a 15-year-old, remember? Back in what year was that?
2018.
Goodness. And when somebody's so ahead of the curve like that at 15, I'm quite sure if you go back to 2018 and that breakthrough, people, and I include us in that, were probably saying Mira Andreeva type things about her.
Massive hype job.
And it's all just faded, hasn't it? But she's still incredibly young. She's a Ukrainian player. She has dealt with, obviously, a heck of a lot in the past couple of years. And she has been outspoken about it. She's taking it on her shoulders to bear that burden. And I think it's a pretty incredible story, really, that she's reached the quarterfinals here. Just as she's been in prominence in tennis in the last couple of years, but not for her tennis. Just as a tennis player, we'd started to leave her out of the conversation about talented on-the-rise youngsters and started to put her into the also-ran conversation, sort of there and talented and good, and but not kind of, ooh, eyes emoji on that. And I think this is really impressive from her.
Yeah, I completely agree. And three Ukrainian women in the last 16 of this tournament, first time that's ever happened at a slam. There's obviously a chance for two more to reach the quarters along with Kostyuk tomorrow. And yeah, there is just this tension between all this success coming at a time of sort of great sort of personal trauma for them, you know, in their lives, given what's happening in Ukraine. Some very interesting quotes that Kostyuk gave to the WTA in the back end of last year, talking about her new coach, who she linked up with at Wimbledon last year, Sandra Zanivska, who used to coach Petra Martic. And Kostyuk said one of the best things about her is that she's a woman. And she said that we can have sort of frank conversations and conversations where we understand each other, and I just feel able to open up to her more than I have done with male coaches. And if I did so with male coaches, they might not talk back to me. And, you know, that's not to say that all male coaches would be like that, but sort of Kostyuk's experience, she's found it a lot easier to talk to Sandra Zanivska than she had her other coaches. And I just thought that was interesting, especially, and it sort of ties in with what we're saying here, that, you know, Kostyuk's going to be feeling a lot of heavy emotions right now, and will have done ever since the invasion of Ukraine. And it does feel like she's got an outlet for those now with this coaching partnership. And it didn't work straight away. They linked up after Wimbledon. She had a horrible American hard court summer, but she sort of knew that she was feeling better. And, you know, now it really seems to be paying off. And this has been an unexpected, I would say, but really impressive run. And I like her game. She's incredibly athletic and can defend so well, but also has some weapons and can hurt players. And I think that'll be, look, I think Goff will win. I think she's not losing to anyone really that isn't Iga Świątek or Jessica Pegula at the moment, Coco Gauff. But I think that could be a fun match with a lot of sort of dynamic athletic rallies. I'm looking forward to that one. And yeah, good on Marta Kostyuk.
I hadn't heard those quotes. And I think I'm so pleased to hear a player express that, because it's always something that's on my mind, the lack of females in female players' teams. They don't have to be coaches, they can be fitness trainers, whatever. Like, there are so many exclusively male boxers, and it's an incredibly all-consuming, sometimes lonely life being a touring tennis player. You're not going home every night and going out for dinner with your mates. That's your life, the people in that team. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with a woman being on a team with men. I sit here on a team with men. It's fantastic. It's brilliant. But A, I'm pretty lucky with the men I'm on a team with, and I'm not saying that there aren't great men out there, but it can sometimes be a very testosterone heavy vibe in those players' boxes, and sometimes I look at them and I think, God, don't you ever just crave some female energy? Or maybe they don't, because they don't know what they're missing. But it's a concern for me because of that element of that being everything, you know. Mm. And maybe they're going home and calling their sister or their best mate or whatever it is, but it's not the same. And hearing Marta Kostyuk express that is quite heartening, really. And I'm pleased for her. I really am. So that's day 8 at the Australian Open. What does day 9 have in store? Rod Laver Arena starts with Victoria Azarenka against Diana Yastremska, another Ukrainian player qualifier. Then Nuno Borges plays on Rod Laver Arena. Nuno Borges.
He was all over the front pages of the Portuguese newspapers today. Great to see.
He plays Daniil Medvedev tomorrow, and then the night session is Carlos Alcaraz against Mirmir Kecmanovic, and that is followed by Zheng Qinwen against Ossian Dodan. That match should not be second after Alcaraz Kecmanovic. Anyway, Margaret Court. Oh, no, sorry. The second court tomorrow starts with doubles. Then we have Noshkova Svitolina. I am fascinated by this match. So many people today, members of the media, a couple of podcast fans that have come up to us and said hi, have asked whether Noshkova can back this up. And we have just unilaterally said, I don't know.
Can't wait to find out.
We're about to find out.
It's a tough opponent to back up a big win against.
It is. You know, I hovered over this little teaser for the newsletter. I did hover over Noshkova, just thinking with the predictions, maybe she's one of those players that has it. But what a tough task, beating Alina Svitolina. The way she's playing, I mean, it's hard enough. It used to be hard enough anyway, but now she's made of something else. Her approach is so much more aggressive. She feels like a different player, Svitolina, to the one from 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And so, ultimately, I just didn't have the confidence. Or the nerve.
And then it's not a night session on the second court tomorrow. It's a sort of twilight session, isn't it? It's a not before 4 p.m. Zverev against Norrie. Never beaten him. I don't think he's ever won a set, Norrie, off Zverev.
He's never got close.
Can he do it tomorrow?
I think he's going to play like he did against Casper Ruud. I don't know whether it'll be enough. I kind of think it might be, because I was so taken by him, as I said last night.
What a journey David's been on. Yeah. He was a Mannarino guy, now he's a Norrie guy.
I'm all for second chances, third chances, fifth chances.
John Cain Arena tomorrow is where you'll find Artur Kazul and Hubert Hurkacz. What a contrast in vibe between those two.
I'm looking forward to it.
Then it's Jasmine Paolini against Anna Kalinskaya. And there's all sorts of doubles happening about the place tomorrow. Haddad Meyer and Townsend, they're in doubles action on the Kia Arena. Juniors are happening. It's all happening. But that's where the singles matches are tomorrow. And we'll be back with a podcast to talk about them. We have a mascot. That mascot is Usher. Hello to Usher.
Right,
Thank
Usher.
You for being a wonderful mascot. We have our mascots. I've got Darwin. Still can't believe it. We got points today. Oh my God.
I was going to say, when were you going to bring that up?
Just feels like such a long way back.
It's the first time that I can now no longer hide behind your appalling record, because I think I've got about five in a row wrong. So
Matt's got Hyder and Soma.
I do, yes, and don't have points today because I was head to head with you.
Which, you know, generally speaking, a good play.
I thought was a good tactic.
Not today. David and Francis. Look, it Francis, Darwin, Hyder, Soma. It's been a tough week.
Yeah, we've not exactly covered ourselves in glory on your behalves. But still, there's still time.
There's still time. So many points still on the line. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have top folks and executive producers Greg, Chris, Jamie and Jeff. And I'm very sad to say that once again, in lieu of shout-outs, we have a tribute this time to another dearly departed member of the tennis community, one you might very well know, Alan Mills, the longtime former referee of Wimbledon, much beloved in the tennis world. He passed away, David, a couple of days ago, aged 88.
Yeah, and he really was so quintessentially ever-present at Wimbledon throughout my whole life. I don't remember watching Wimbledon as a child without him as the referee, without him. And of course, the role was so much more visible back then because there wasn't a roof. So every time a little bit of rain was in the air, he would just appear on the end of the court and have a look up at the rain and try to work out when to pull them off and whatnot.
His autobiography was called Lifting the Covers, wasn't it?
Yes.
It's just so perfect.
And, you know, he was somebody that John McEnroe Alan was telling us in a podcast that we did together in 2015. He told you and I that John McEnroe called him onto the court. It was the first time that Alan had ever been summoned to a court, and it was by an 18-year-old John McEnroe. And he'd never met McEnroe before, and he went on there and he had to deal with him. And he had his moments. You know, he had, everybody did with McEnroe back then particularly. But he said in that interview with us, he said, you know, the secret was to just give him an answer immediately. Don't have a conversation, just stick to your principles, stick to your guns, and then he would accept it. And he did it with such kind of calm manner, but forthright at the same time. And he had some humour. You know, John loved him. John respected him. And he was so warm when Alan retired at that Champions Tour event at the Royal Albert Hall in 2015. And Alan, on a personal note, was always very welcoming to me. Like I said, to me, he was the guy off the telly, you know, when I was a kid. And I came in and he was always really friendly and welcoming to me and kind. And then he appeared on this podcast with Catherine and I on our end of season awards. I actually had a listen to it last night. We're linking to it in our newsletter tonight. You and I made our cases for Player of the Year.
He was the adjudicator of the end of season awards.
Yeah, and he was brilliant at it. And he really realized what role we wanted him to play. And
he
hammed it up with us, and he was great fun. And he'll be really, really missed and really fondly thought of. In the future, you know, he will be warmly remembered.
He certainly will. Yeah, Simon Briggs has written a lovely tribute to him, hasn't he? And speaking of lovely tributes, just on the subject of our colleague Mike Dixon that passed away so suddenly this week, there is a lovely tribute to him by Tim Hemman in the Daily Mail that has appeared today, and it's incredibly heartfelt. He doesn't do emotion like that very often, Tim. It's very touching indeed. So that's it for day 8 of the Australian Open. We'll be back with day 9 tomorrow. We can't promise better hype jobs, but we will match dependent. We'll try, and we'll speak to you then.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare tri-term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare tri-term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.